I'm with Mrs. Nancy Wright, is that correct?
Yes.
Wright, your maiden name was?
Nancy Adair.
Nancy Adair. And date today is 29 August 1978, and we're at 10 Mile Point in Victoria. Your family started off in England, then you yourself were born in England, but then
yes.
you moved to Canada when you were approximately 5 years old due to your father's health, and you stayed until 1938 and did your schooling at St. Catharines, is correct?
Yes, that's right.
Correct. Then when you went from there, then you went back to England, grandfather had died. What was the circumstances there?
Yes, my grandfather had died and left us this home in England, and this is why we did return there, because really to fix up the inheritance. And besides, my father wanted to by this time, and especially my mother, she wanted to go home to her. It was home. To me, of course, it wasn't.
You weren't thinking too highly of it at the time.
Well, when you have grown up in a country, you know, I mean, I knew only Canada from five until this time when I was around about 18. Those are very formative, very special years to anybody, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my roots were there.
This home that you came back to, though, was very close to Bexley Park, is that correct?
Yes, it was 9 miles away.
Nine miles away. It had an interesting name, what was it?
It was called Heathwood. Oh, the house was Heathwood, but the name of the town, the little town, was Leighton Buzzard.
Leighton Buzzard.
Yes.
And the house's name was Heathwood.
Heathwood.
It was in the, what, Greater London, or just how?
Oh, no, this was 45, we were 47 miles straight north of London.
Straight north,
yes.
47 miles.
This is why Bletchley was such a great place, because it was north, because it would be safer.
Quieter.
Yes, quieter. Right bang in the middle of England, really. And that's right.
You started off when war broke out. You wish to join the forces? Is this because your father had served in the First War and this type of thing?
Oh, no, it's not that. I think that, I mean, we all knew that we were going to be in for a pretty tough time of it, and the essential thing, I mean, if you're young, I mean, you want to do something for your country. I particularly fancied the Wrens. I don't really quite know why. Possibly I liked the uniform. Maybe I thought that would be a little bit more flattering to me. This is what I wanted to do, to get into something.
Yeah,
everybody, all your friends, everybody was, you know, we've got to join up, you know, we've got to go.
Yeah, you had a difficult time getting in, or trying to attempt to get into the Wrens. You had to apply different, because of your education, by leaving in your last year of high school back to come to England or something.
Well, I think it was because at first, you know, this was, now we're talking about 1940, early 1940. Nothing was very, very organized at that time. And they were taking people in who had a specific either trade or specific qualifications. The typists. All those that had any nursing abilities. A cook.
Mm-hmm.
Cooking. Driving. Truck driving. All that sort of thing. You know, you could go in and say, I am a this, or secretarial work, typing, all that sort of thing. They just picked those people up fast. But of course, I had always just grown up and lived on the farm, and I was at school in Canada before going to England, and I was taking ballet because I'd taken it in Canada prior to
mm-hmm.
coming to England, and this was just purely aspiring to be a ballet dancer. I was wanting to teach, and I was going in for my intermediary to be able to teach ballet. But of course, I mean, the war coming, I mean, all this,
mm-hmm.
the ballet school was in the middle of London. And, but the war on, this soon folded. All these people went to ENSA. A lot of these girls that were in ballet school joined up with ENSA, which was entertainment for the forces. It wasn't quite what entertainment, but something to do with the services abroad anyway. And these people go out and did eventually go out and entertain the forces in Africa and all over, you know, and in France before France collapsed. But of course, their idea of me ever mentioning to my parents that I would like to go to Ensign, of course, I was underage. I had to have their approval, and no way, as they say today, no way.
Yeah, no.
And besides, it was a little risky because a lot of it wasn't well organized. And there were cases where some companies got partly stranded in Africa and couldn't get their way back. And, you know, things were moving very quickly in 1941, later on.
Mm-hmm.
This was, and there were some really rather, you know, tricky situations with ENSA and all those entertainment people. So I did manage to have my name down on a list in the Wrens. I remember, of course, I could drive trucks and I could drive cars, and being interviewed by this Queen Wren and stating the fact that, you know, that I could drive anything on four wheels, to which he looked up at me very coldly, said, "And how are you on two?" Meaning motorbikes. Right. And I said, "Well, I had never tried to." But I said I would be willing to try for that. She looked at me up and down. Of course, I was only weighed about 100 pounds in those days. And she said, "Well, I hope you'll be able to lift it." So at any rate, she took my name and application down and said that they would possibly be getting in touch with me, but certainly not before another 6 months. Or 8 months. Well, I didn't want to hang around for that. And I was telling my woes to someone who was at Bletchley Park and who was billeted in the local in the hotel, the Swan Hotel in Leighton Buzzard. He was a squadron leader in the Air Force.
His name at all?
John Moore.
Must be the Royal Air Force.
Yes. But, I mean, he was, he worked in, at Bletchley. To this day, I don't know what he did. Or whereabouts he worked in Bletchley.
You had mentioned before that we started the tape that Bletchley Park had sort of a queer reputation in that they had been going since, you said, 38, or...
When it was starting.
39. Things were starting and there was a lot of weird people walking
39,
around.
39. Yes, around about 39. Well, they were brainy, clever people. Very, you know, the young professor, absent-minded professor type. Mathematicians, linguists. These were the brains who were sent down to start Bletchley Park going, I think. Because the head of my section was a man by the name of Hugh Alexander. I believe he's been knighted now. I think he's Sir Hugh. But he, in peacetime, was the headmaster of Winchester College. He was also the chess champion of England, great mathematician. He was one of the, what they call the backroom boys, that has been mentioned in the book, Intrepid. He went down to Bletchley with others. And through his being in the education field, of course, he knew others that, excuse me, had, you know, had come through him, or who were great mathematicians, or very, very clever, and he combed, these people combed all the universities. And just somebody who was, say, particularly good in languages, or particularly able in mathematics, or degrees. I mean, if Bletchley Park just said, you know, come you here, you little hound, we'd like to have you. And that
mentioned,
is how
you mentioned
they
that the Anthony's people be walking around the streets talking.
Oh, yes, that's quite usual.
It's not a Hollywood
No
caricature.
No.
People were that odd.
That odd. I assure you they were that odd. Now, in my own section that I worked in, for one example, there was a young professor. Mind you, they were all young at Bletchley. There were very few people there over 35, I would say. They were all young. And this young professor Turing, I assure you, he was just far, far out. He used to come to work on a bicycle. So therefore, he must have been billeted very near Bletchley. But you could hear him coming about a quarter of a mile away, because he never, I mean, the it was old, and the pedals where the spokes used to go around, miles away. And he came into the office once, and one of the girls said to him, "Prof, why don't you put some oil on your bicycle? It makes a dreadful sound." And he said, "Oil? Oil? Yes, oil. Oil. But that's as far as you got, because he didn't even know what you were talking about. He didn't even hear that going. And this would go on. This went on for weeks. And one day when I came in, I mean, we all knew about this, you see, everybody knew this. And one day when I came to the shift, I was just taking over. No, that's right. I was on the shift, and this girl came in to take over from me. And she was roaring with laughter. And I said, what's the joke? Oh, she said, about a quarter of a mile down the road, there's Prof Turing. She said, finally, the pedal has dropped off his bicycle. And he's standing by his bicycle, and he's got this pedal in his hand, and he's making all these, jumping up and down, and he's making all these funny, weird sounds. That's a fact.
And these are the kind of people that
these are the kind of people we worked with.
Well, this squadron leader, we'll get it back, you know, this squadron leader arranged an appointment for you.
That's right.
Well, what happened then? You were given an application?
Application form to fill out. Very lengthy one. A very thorough one.
Do you think that was a bit odd? After you had been down with the Wrens and saw what they were expecting. Did that strike you, or you just young and didn't think about
it? No, I didn't think about it, really. Because some of those forms that you had to fill out, which I'd done another one before that, to try to get into another part of the Wrens, that was fairly lengthy. Anything that was connected with any security at all. They wanted to know, you know, where you lived, what your father did. Was he British? Your mother, her nationality. You know, they did want to know those things. At that time, maybe they were a little bit more as the war progressed and things were getting pretty dicey, and we needed so much more help. Perhaps they weren't so thorough. I don't really know. But I filled out the form, and then about 2 weeks after I'd filled out the form, I was sent a little card to report for an interview. And it's the first time I'd seen Bletchley. But at that time, I drove there, because we still had a car. They had, you know, we had two cars, but with no gasoline during the war. But this was sort of, so you know, early on, 1940, and we still had a bit of gas. And I was going to drive right through the gates, and my goodness, I got as far as the gates, and all of a sudden, two soldiers came with bayonets fixed and all the rest of it. Came and I said, "Miss, where do you think you're going to?" I said, "Oh, I have an interview. It's quite all right. I've got a car here. I'm going to drive in here." You see? They said, "Oh, no, you're not. You just take that car of yours and you put it back there. And then you come and report in here first. So, which I did, and it was pouring with rain, and I was, you know, a bit miffed about having to get myself soaking wet. At any rate, I walked up there, and then they escorted me, while two others took their place, one on each side, and marched me up to the main house, where I was interviewed by I do not know whom.
You don't know who this is?
Because the name was not mentioned to me. I'm sure I would have remembered. He was a commander.
That's was he not a naval type, naval commander?
Yes, but not in uniform, he wasn't.
Not in uniform.
No. Because I heard him being called.
Commander.
Commander. The secretary said, oh, Commander, Miss Adair is here. That's all I know. And he said, oh, how do you do, you see? And he shook hands, but nobody was there to introduce you. I didn't know his name. So then he outlined what would be expected of me in the way of not the what kind of work I would do, but what how it would mean that I would have to work there, and I wouldn't be allowed to quit at all. I was in there for the duration of the war. And also that I would not be allowed even to transfer. I wasn't allowed to say, well, I'm a little bit fed up with this, I don't like it anymore, I think I'd like to join the Reds again. Or I'd like to go into the ATS, or I'd like to go into WAF or whatever. You couldn't do that. You were there. And unless, of course, you're married. And even if you married, you still had to continue, unless, of course.
What about your choice of a husband? Did that come under scrutiny also?
Do you know, I've been trying to think about that, and I, you know, you having to throw your mind back so long, you know, this is about 38 years ago, and I have a feeling that, that there was a mention that it wouldn't be very desirable in their eyes if you kept company or had a boyfriend who was not British or Canadian. Of course, that would be British. Because I think, of course, we had Free French, we had Czechoslovakian troops, we had Poles, we had Norwegians later, when Norway fell, I suppose they thought, well, you know, you might make a slip, or you might get romantically involved, or you might get married, and then I don't know. I've never known anybody be in that position. But I think there was a mention of that it was expected that you wouldn't keep too much company with other forces other than British.
Let alone civilians.
That's right. But I can't absolutely, you know, my heart was in my mouth while I was there. And then, of course, you had to make a choice. You had to say, all right, I don't think I'll have any part of this, and then you could turn around and be escorted home. Or you had to make up your mind then and there where you can, you know, stay or not. And I chose to stay. And then, of course, the Official Secrets Act. And they read it out to you in detail. And by the time they had done that, I think if somebody had asked me what my name was, you know, I would have hedged it a little bit. But they didn't tell you at all. I kept on asking. Well, I was worried, you see. I was terribly worried. Because I was worried in case I wasn't up to, you know, their expected task that it would be. You know, I was wondering whether, you know, am I going to be bright enough to be able to manage a job here? Well, what do they expect of me? What am I supposed to do? If they could have possibly told me, all right, what are you going to do? Or give me a little bit. But no, not a word. I kept on asking. And they said, well, Mr. Dare, we haven't quite figured out yet what department we'll put you in, but I assure you that you will be trained, and you have absolutely nothing to worry about. They were very, very nice.
You were to continue living at home as well?
Yes, yes.
What about salary, wages, this type of thing?
Oh, the salary. That was... I got 8 and 6 a week.
How would that compare with the rent?
That would be about, with this pound in those days sitting at $4.80, 10 shillings would have been $2.40. And I got less than that. So it'd be about $2 a week. Yes, that. And they also didn't tell me when I'd signed on that dear dotted line, the hours. The hours were unbelievable. We worked 3 shifts. We worked, this is in my department, in my section. We worked from 9 o'clock in the morning till 4 o'clock in the afternoon, which was money for jam. That was lovely. And we did our night shift right after the day shift. We did that from midnight until 9 in the morning. That was 9 hours. And we did our, what we called our evening shift, which was what was from 4 o'clock in the afternoon till 12 at night. We did have transportation. At this time, when I joined, all the personnel were billeted at different people's homes, except those that, like myself, mm-hmm. that did happen to be living at home. And we were picked up.
What about clothing and things like this? Now, you weren't in any particular force, but did they give you a clothing ration?
No. Oh, good heavens, no. Nothing. Not a thing.
This would come out of your 2 pounds a week.
That's right.
Uh-huh.
And we had 1 day off a week.
1 day off?
1 day off a week. In other words, we worked 6 days a week. We were supposed to get 1 week's leave every 3 months, which was equivalent to what the forces were
mm-hmm.
generally getting, you see. But that was just a lovely idea. The odd time, I was there, what, from 1940 until the end of the European War.
In 1945.
And I do remember I had some leaves, but there weren't very many of them. Because it got more hectic and more hectic as time went on. And also as we got better at our work.
Well, when you first started now, what did you tell your parents, for example? That you had a job down the end of the road or what?
Oh no. We just said that we had a work as a temporary civil servant. And we did just civil service work, just general office work.
Working those kind of hours?
Those kind of hours.
Did anyone believe you?
No, I don't think so. But they had the good grace, and I mean, they knew that possibly, well, I mean, they knew it was a secret place, but I mean, you don't. You know, you feel, you know instinctively that this person is working possibly has had to sign the Official Secret Act. You just don't needle them. You don't, you
need to know
let
basis
go.
Type of thing?
And this, beg your pardon?
Need to know type basis?
That's right. I mean, I think that, that was it. You just were doing. And I remember being my mother asking me, and I said, darling, I'm awfully sorry, but I really can't tell you. I mean, it's just it's sort of secret work. As a matter of fact, I don't really understand too much about it myself yet, I'm new, and I don't know too much about it. And as a matter of fact, and this is quite true, that I worked there for 3 months before I knew what it was all about.
What did they do for the first 3 months?
Well, I was put on a machine which was called Einsing. I've forgotten about it now, really. Oh, it had some dials, and you had to do something or other. And I can't remember. I was only there for such a little time. It was a fairly simple job. Very simple, in fact. And I asked a lot of questions. I was a very nosy little person. But I got awfully bored with this. I got terribly bored.
I didn't like coding type machine or what?
No, this was something to do with the breaking down of messages that were received, which they thought that they, you know, they were trying to break. The mathematicians that were in our department, when they would take hold of this German message or something, and they would think, well, now we think it's going to say this. We think this operator is going to start off with this thing. And then, of course, the machines were put up in such a way that they tried to break down all the different, must have been thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of groupings of letters and the way it would, where they thought it was, what it was going to say. And this must have been something to do with this breaking down or eliminating some possible bits. All right, eins, there is a German word for one. Could possibly be that it was, you know, that.
You were saying eins is a German word.
For one.
Yeah.
Possibly this was used. Maybe they thought that it would start out with the name one, or maybe it was, I don't really know. I haven't a clue.
She worked this thing for 3 months.
Only 3 months, that's right. And this was in a big room with, must have been 60 girls on a shift.
And you were one of 60?
One of 60. And then there was another little room at the far end of the... We were in Nissen huts in those days. And I seemed to like what... I thought that looked much more interesting place to work. And I got to know the girl that was working in there, and she had one of these little testing Enigma machines. And I thought that I would like to learn how to do that. Finally, I did go to the head of my section, and I did tell him that I was very bored with the work I was doing, and I would like to have something a little bit better if I could. And I said that I had inquired at the far end of the hall, and they might be needing somebody a little bit later on. And please, if it's possible, I'd like to get in there. And so, as it happened, I managed to get in there. And that's the kind of work I did till the rest of the end of the war.
So you actually operated the Enigma machine?
That's right. It was the same little machine that the operators used in the submarines, or the, you know, like the radio mm-hmm. operator, when he got his message. He set up his wheels. He set up, had his setting, he had his message that was sent to him in code, and then he just typed it all out, and out it came in German, you see. So, we...
How complicated was the machine to use? Very simple?
to use?
Mm-hmm.
Quite
to
simple.
Use. Well, the thought behind it, did it strike you as, like, who could dream up this type of thing?
Or? Oh, yes.
Very impressed.
Yes. And they had big computer types of machines that would break down It was mentioned in Intrepid, or I think perhaps Ultra Secret, called The Bomb. B-O-M-B-E. And this was used to help break down all the settings for what these messages would say. And they would, the Wrens operated these. And at outstations too. Where these machines stopped, they would phone the setting in to us. And we would have a whole list, masses of them sometimes, and then we would have the wheel alignment and our clips, and we would set the wheels up, we'd set the stop up, and then we'd have our message, and out we would type. And as soon as we got German, of course, then we knew we had broken that day.
Would you like me to make tea?
Oh, you can put the kettle on for me, darling. Yeah. That'd be lovely. Thank you.
So you just got these settings and then typed in the message you got.
Very exciting, because I mean, you never knew which one, or whether you sometimes would go on for days and days and days when nobody broke anything. At the beginning of the war, it was very rough. But we got more equipment all the time, you know.
What about the messages themselves? I guess you didn't speak German or
No,
German,
I didn't.
So
no.
You would be a good security risk in that you didn't know what it said anyway.
No.
Right?
That's true. But there were, of course, others, of course, did. This, of course, this again is only my section, you see. I worked in what they call the German naval section. All we tried to do, all we handled, was the German naval code.
The U-boat.
That's right.
E-bars.
And for the Battle of Atlantic and all that, you
right.
see, which was very important. At the very beginning of the war, when I was there, we did do some work for another hut, which was breaking the code for the Battle of Britain. So we any machines that we had, although Navy was generally had priority, then we did not have that priority. I mean, because we worked for the air at that time,
mm-hmm.
because the Battle of Britain was on and this was an emergency, we had to have that. And they managed to break that very well, I believe.
It became a very routine type thing. You waited and just started doing your typing.
You were just typing up the messages, and well, I mean, you just cut them out. Yes, it was, but everyone was, I don't know, was different somehow. It was a routine in some aspects.
Well, the type of characters walking around, you mentioned Ian Fleming was around there at one time, the author.
That's right.
And others, the people coming and going, very...
There were people coming and going there.
Very busy place.
Very busy.
Lots of people knew of it existed, or...
Big Ben?
Lots of people know of its existence type of thing at during the time. I guess there's a lot of people passing through is what I'm asking. The numbers of people, there are a lot of transients coming in and out.
But coming into Bletchley and coming out of Bletchley?
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't say there was that transient business at all. I think that with some of the heads, the higher ups, they would come and be at Bletchley for maybe 2 or 3 months and then they'd disappear. But then they would come back again.
And you never knew the existence
you didn't
of Steve
know,
or any of these people?
No. We didn't.
Well, the highest guy up you knew would be this Alexander character?
Well, that's the man who I worked
your
with.
Boss.
But, I mean, there was a head of the of Bletchley Park. I was, Commander Travis was there while I was there. Commander Dennison was there. But, of course, these people, I mean, they did change. They went somewhere else. Of course, some of them were, I suppose, sent back to... after a while to the Caribbean and to the United States. So, but as far as my own section was concerned, the same people were there at the end. They, you know, I mean, we did employ more staff a little bit more, but we were always there. And The thing is, you see, when you're doing shift work like this, and like I was situated at that home or wherever we were billeted, it didn't make any difference, you're picked up by your transportation, driven into Bletchley, and you get out of that either the bus or station wagon, whichever it might be. You immediately went to your own block or your own section. And there would be an IC ops of your shift. There would be an IC operations of what was going on at the time. And you'd look through the log book and see what had to be done, and you got with it and you did your work. We did have a cafeteria, but that, for security reasons also, was outside the gates. So you had a pass to go in, which you had to flash in. And then when you went out to the cafeteria to eat your dinner or breakfast or whatever it was, whatever shift you were on, you had to show this again. So out you went and back again.
Signed in and signed out in between.
Yes, well, you just showed your pass. Yeah. And that was it.
Did you have to pay for your meals?
No, they did give us our meals. I assure you, I wouldn't have given you anything for them anyway. They were atrocious.
Is that right?
Yes. But these, as far as Bletchley is concerned, though, I have never known people work like they did. Never. Like people like Professor Turing, this is my own section again I'm talking about, because that's all I can talk about, because that's all I know, because I don't know what went on in anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sure it would be the same. These people would come to work. They were supposed to be on shifts too. But they would go the whole two shifts or something. They would work maybe 16 hours a day. They were fantastic workers. They were possessed, literally. We all worked very, very hard. And they were very long hours. And it was cold, because we didn't have any heat. Now, after, when we got bigger, I think it was around about 1941, we moved from Nissen huts into great big block, cement blocked and brick and cement buildings. And there was a sort of semblance of a heat, I think, if I remember rightly, down the corridor, but there was absolutely nothing in our office at all. Not a thing. And the windows were very high, and they were made of a plastic, it was sort of a plastic material, in a covering a very, very fine mesh. This was in case, I suppose, we were bombed, that we're not going to have flying glass all over the place. But that was all very well. But as the winter gales came, and wind and rain and that sort of thing, those little holes came in that little mesh.
Mm-hmm.
And it was cold. We, at night shift, we worked, as I said, I would be picked up. This is how my night would begin. I would be picked up at about 10 past 11 at night and driven into to work. And we'd take over and we'd work. All we girls wore slacks, corduroy slacks. And there were umpteen sweaters. I even had a little leather waistcoat, I remember, and a Harris tweed jacket. And even some of the girls wore these little mittens with their fingers cut off, because it was so cold. And this is where, those lovely hot drinks, those...
Courtesy of Canadian family.
Yes.
I'm going to bring that in towards the end, isn't it?
Yes.
You would go in then, you would go in at midnight. You would start your work at midnight.
Midnight.
And you would stay there until 9 o'clock in the morning.
That's right. We had two breaks, though. We could have gone, but we never took it. We used to have a meal around about 2. We used to go over to the cafeteria. It was commonly known as the cafeteria, so you can imagine what it was like. And have coffee or something like that. And then come on back. We had breakfast later on. Then we got on our transportations at 9, and I would get home into my own home around about 9:45. And that, we used to try and work the whole 2 weeks without a day off. So then we could take, we could have 2 days off with the changeover shift. That means you came off on a Sunday morning at 9 and I didn't have to go back to work till 4 o'clock on the Wednesday. But you couldn't always do that, I mean, because, you know, you have to leave the shift so that it was strong. Only two of us were allowed to have the day off together.
How many people were in your particular section?
At its height?
At its height, sir.
Yeah, that's never a quick question I've never even thought of. A good few hundred.
Working in England?
Yes. On the naval code.
On the naval code. For submarines and surface raiders.
Yes.
Not all in one room, you're all...
Oh, no.
All spread out in different areas.
That's right. All spread out. Yeah, well, I mean, it was all, it's like one section came. But, I mean, of course, there were these same Enigma was used for all sorts of other, you know, with other breaking of the codes. I mean, there again, you see, I only know my own part in it.
Was there, was the case then that you didn't know other people in your own section type thing?
Oh, yes, we all knew pretty well, all the people we worked with, oh, except we didn't know those that were on the other shift. You see, this is it. Because you never came across them.
They'd be gone before.
You see, they would come on the... See, the place never shut down, never could stopped. Mm. See, those that were on duty at 9 o'clock in the morning till 4, then the next lot came in and took a... I mean, you just said hello and that sort of thing. What's doing this and that and the other? They'd say, oh, this is on the log or that's on the log or so-and-so and so-and-so. Oh, you've got to go and check with Mr. Alexander about so-and-so and you go, you've got to see somebody else about something or other. And that was it. Then we just... They got off their chair and we sat on it.
Mm-hmm.
Then the same thing happened when we took off. Then the next shift came for us because you see that we had 3 shifts. That never stopped. It never stopped for a minute.
Until May 45. Well, what happened at the end of the war when they unleashed all these
that was
workaholics?
Well, they they were absorbed in other work.
You didn't choose to follow up with civil service, or did you?
Well, as a matter of fact, I did stay on after 45. I love the word. I was declared redundant for 3 weeks. That was a heavenly time. And I went on leave. I had to tell them, let them know where I was, though. They went to a little village called Broadway, I remember. Really sort of, you know, we didn't have any money to spend too much because we had certainly hadn't earned it. But, you know, it was just, that was heaven. And then I was asked to come back, and I went back to Bletchley Park, and I worked in some other different work. And then Bletchley disbanded, and I was sent to a place called Eastcote. This was, of course, after the war was over.
Same type of thing?
Not really.
What type of work is involved in?
I'm afraid that's something I
That's something
say.
Else, okay.
Because that has never been...
publicized.
Nothing,
no. That's fair enough. How did you feel about the publication? I mean, it had been kept a secret for so long. Were you expecting it at any moment?
No. No, I wasn't. No, I was... I was terribly surprised, really, in a way. Now, at the time, I do remember us being told, you see, that that we'd never we'd be allowed to tell anyone of the nature of our work or what any of us did. But possibly there couldn't be a chance we might be able to tell our grandchildren one day. So I think that the powers that be then knew after, what it is it, the Statue of Limitations or something,
yes,
that possibly this would come out. Because I am sure that all the, now, I mean, you take espionage, you take codes and ciphering and all this type of work nowadays. I mean, it's all done by satellites, and it's, you know, this would be all old hat. I mean, who would do that nowadays? You see, you'd have a different thing altogether.
Well, I hope you got a raise after the war.
Well, I got a little bit better salary, but after the war, we got very damn little, you know, really. Because there wasn't that money, I suppose. But
you felt your work at the time, though. You felt your work at the time was most important and valuable.
Oh, we knew that. Oh, yes, because we were told. Now, as soon as I got off of that miserable little room with the Einzing job and got in on this other, on my Enigma.
What was it called, Enigma?
No, we didn't call it anything.
Didn't call it anything.
You see, it was just, this is your machine. And this is what we do with this. And I said, well, where did this come from? Because actually it was all in German.
Mm-hmm.
Because this had been pinched off a German sub.
Yours was the naval one, that's right.
Yes.
That's right.
And all, and so, you know, it was, it either came out of